The holidays are expensive. You're paying for gifts, travel, decorations, food, and before you know it, you've blown way past what you were planning to spend. Don't start the new year off with bad money vibes. Download Rocket Money to stay on top of your finances. The app pulls your income, expenses, and upcoming charges into one place so you can get the clearest picture of your money. It shows how much to set aside for bills and how much is safe to spend for the month so you can spend with confidence. No guesswork needed. Get alerts before bills hit. Track budgets and see every subscription you're paying for. Rocket Money also finds extra ways to save you money by canceling subscriptions you're not using and negotiating lower bills for you. On average, Rocket Money users can save up to $740 a year when using all of the app's premium features. Start the year off right by taking control of your finances. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Page 94, the Private Eye Podcast.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Page 94. My name's Andrew Hunter-Murray and I'm here in the Eye studio with Helen Lewis, Adam McQueen and Ian Hislop. It's a new year, but it's lots of the same old news. So firstly, let's go over, Helen, to your patch, to America, because we wanted to talk about ICE, immigration and customs enforcement, not least due to the, let's say, the fatal shooting of a young American woman, Renee Good.
So ICE has been around since 2003. However, under the first Trump term, it massively ramped up. And this time it has gone absolutely crazy. They have, I think, doubled the number of agents. They put aside tens of billions of pounds. Do you remember the Big Beautiful Bill? Just massively increased the funding to it. And it always had two parts, one of which was basically like tracking down fentanyl smugglers and, you know, child trafficking rings and things like that. And another was finding day-to-day immigrants whose only offence was overstaying their visa or entering the country illegally, whatever. And really, it sucked all the resources from that bit, the smashing the gangs bit, to essentially going door to door and hassling people's gardeners and stuff like that, right? One of the ways that Trump has used it is he has sent it, along with the National Guard, into blue cities, many of which have explicitly declared that they're kind of sanctuaries. Their local law enforcement don't want to cooperate with ICE. ICE is incredibly unpopular. Actually, now a majority of Democrats want it abolished. Because what they do is they dress up in kind of camo gear and cover their faces and hassle people dropping their kids off at nursery or whatever it might be. They are renowned as being a kind of, you know, unpleasant paramilitary kind of style force on American streets.
And you've said that if you recruit people in a hurry with none of the usual safeguards, that's who you get.
Yeah, I think so. They say it like should take about 18 months to train an agent. They just haven't had the time to do that, even in the Trump term. You know, where are they getting these people from? Are they vetting them enough? You know, we had the story here in Britain about the Met dropping some of its vetting because they had such a push to put on new officers. So politicians kind of think it's amazing to say, let's have more bobbies on the beat, let's have more ICE officers. But, you know, if you shortcut that process, you do it at your peril.
And the Metropolitan Police have had to drop plenty of officers they recruited because they found they've been guilty of various quite serious offences,
yeah.
Violent crimes or sexual crimes or whatever it might be.
Although not the case for the guy who shot Rene Good. Now, he had been in ICE for 10 years. He was a military veteran. However, there were a couple of things that were really important to what happened there. One was that about 6 months ago, he had another traffic stop, tried to open a door, knocked through the window, tried to open the door from the inside, and then ended up being dragged along the road. And that is against protocol, by the way. You shouldn't hang on to a vehicle when it's driving. Also, most law enforcement agencies in the US, you are told not to shoot into a moving vehicle. Because guess what? One of the things that can happen is if someone gets shot, they put their foot down on the accelerator and they might then take out someone else. So this person was not really obeying the kind of code of conduct man you would hope. The incident also escalated incredibly quickly from the woman in the car saying, you know, nothing, go about your day, to within 10 seconds getting shot. It wasn't one of those really unpleasant policing situations where you see, you know, people like the police are just overwhelmed and might be kind of in fear of what's going to happen next. The administration's argument is that the officer was in fear of his life. He thought he was going to get run over.
Trump directly said he was run over.
Yeah,
and went to hospital.
And there's video when you can see her wheels are turning to go past him, and also you see him walking away. But for me, the whole situation is really unpleasant. For me, the most unpleasant bit about this is that immediately afterwards, on the video that the Trump administration released, after taken by him, the officer who shot Renee Good, he says, fucking bitch, immediately after shooting her three times through the window. And to me, that just says that is an officer who is annoyed right? Not somebody who is in fear of their life, who's terrified, but someone who is just has panicked and lost control. And I think that's what really worries people about the way that ICE is working in the US, is that you have undisciplined, heavily armed officers doing unpopular law enforcement with limited powers. They're not supposed to go after citizens. Rene Good was a citizen. And being followed around now by, as a result, protesters. And it's, I don't think it's an overstatement to say that I think the Trump administration quite likes this ratcheting up dynamic where what they would call kind of blue-haired lesbians are now getting into rucks with ICE officers. The ICE officers are now essentially, I would say, almost permitted to be violent, because we know from the pardons of all the January 6 protesters, many of whom attacked police officers, that anyone who does violence in the name of Trump probably going to get a Trump pardon, even if it makes it as far as the courts and they get convicted.
J.D. Vance, I think, has actually explicitly said he's got immunity from prosecution, hasn't he, the officer?
J.D. Vance and immediately, and other members of the administration immediately came out and said she deserved it, more or less those terms. And then you had all these MAGA-affiliated influencers. There's a new term that they bring up now, that she was an affluent, white, female, urban liberal. And such people are, of course, extremely uppity and annoying, and they're exactly the kind of people who are overly sympathetic to illegal immigration. They get in the way of male law enforcement officers, and they don't realise how violent it could be and what's coming to them.
And they deserve to die.
I think that's the screaming subtext of it, right? That you got in the way of him. She wasn't really doing anything illegal that is immediately obvious. You could say that possibly she was refusing to comply with their orders.
She parked the car in the middle of the road, I suppose. That's illegal.
Yeah, I mean, but it's extremely...
She was trying to remove the car from the middle of the road at the moment when she got shot, wasn't she?
Yeah, but that's what I mean. It's all extremely tenuous. And their explanation is they were acting as legal observers of what ICE were doing. So that's the kind of thing that you'd end up getting litigated in a court case. But of course, ICE is going to... So another thing that Trump did, abolish the three oversight agencies that look into ICE's officers and what they do.
Where is the oversight?
The Trump admin has blocked Minnesota as a blue state from investigating this. The FBI under Cash Patel might look into it, but I just think they're equally as likely to look into whether or not she was a criminal as the officer who shot her. And I don't really see how you get a conviction in the circumstances where very senior people in the administration have already come out and said he did nothing wrong, she deserved it. As a politician, you're kind of supposed to... That's why they say all those platitudes, right, about, like, we'll let the investigation take its course, I don't want to rush to judgment. Because the alternative is this, which is basically, you know, Trump has declared her innocent and then... Declare the officer innocent, yeah.
And this seemed to me a very specific example of undermining reality, which Trump has done, so that he shows the video. People can see the videos that the officer took themselves. And then the action is then described in a way that's totally unrecognisable to what you're watching by the official spokesman. So you get to the point where we've all been saying it for a very long time, is that, you know, the assault on reality, there's no such thing as truth anymore. But you watch that and you think, does it not matter at all what we're seeing?
I mean, I don't think it does to the kind of information sphere that he's got around him, you know. And I agree with you, it's really disturbing. But everything that Trump has done with ICE, I think, is really disturbing. So he's massively expanded it. There was a target of 3,000 arrests a day, loads more money for it, while at the same time reducing the amount of money for immigration judges. So the idea is that people just get kept in detainment for a long time. And here's something that I thought was very private-ish when I read about it. Constant revolving door between top ICE officials and, say, private prison providers, the kind of people who get contracts to run detention centres. So there is a kind of, yeah, ICE industrial complex, essentially, that a lot of people are making a lot of money out of. And there are some, you know, even for people watching this who probably aren't going to be legal immigrants to America, need to be aware of some stuff that's been happening, like they will stop people for no reason. Visa overstayers, for example, if you overstay your ESTA or your visa, that has ended up with British nationals being held in, like, Louisiana prisons for several months before getting through the system. People turning up to visa appointments and getting arrested on the way into those, you know? Like, someone will classically sort of say goodbye to their wife and child, go into the appointment, and some tiny bit on their record will have flagged something, and then they just won't come out again. And no one will understand what's happened to them for several days until they finally get their phone call. I mean, it is... I try not to get too hysterical about things that are happening under Trump, but this is one that I think people should be aware of, because I think it not only affects America, it affects us over here too. If you're travelling to America, you kind of want to be aware that this is what's happening. You know, there are essentially heavily armed paramilitary forces wandering around the cities of America.
at the same time as he's threatening military action against Iran for shooting protesters.
Well, he's threatening military action against everybody.
Yes, I mean, his new thing now, isn't it? The man who was going to stop forever wars now just wants forever wars with everyone. Yeah.
I'm sort of curious because so many of these incidents are filmed from several angles because everyone has a phone in the pocket these days and they can do. I'm just curious about what is happening in incidents which aren't filmed. If this is how bad things are getting in incidents which there are several shots of.
Yeah, I mean, ICE has been involved in several shootings already in the Trump term, and there's definitely an uptick in trends of them doing that. And you're right, what on earth is happening in those detention centres where no one has a mobile phone? We know the conditions in them can be really quite unpleasant. You know, at one point, Trump was shipping people off to CECOT, you know, the prison in
San Salvador.
Exactly, he was under Bukele. The whole idea is basically, we want this to be horrible. And grotesquely, obviously horrible, because we want people to either self-deport or not try and take the risk of illegal immigration in the first place. You know, my Atlantic colleague Adam Sower wrote about it and said, you know, the cruelty is the point. Right? This is not happening by accident.
Can I ask you about the idea you're being told what to do by a lippy woman being completely unacceptable? Because on the video bits I've seen, at one point, the deceased's partner says, go and have lunch, what are you doing, in a way that is a tiny bit confrontational.
Well, she's taunting him, isn't she?
It's cheeky rather than aggressive, isn't it? It's teasing.
But my own limited experience of America and obviously watching too many films is if an American police officer of any description comes near you, you just do whatever you're told because you don't want to die.
Well, they're not real law enforcement in the sense that they don't have the right to arrest citizens. They're there to do civil enforcement of immigration offences, right? They're not there to, if you run a red light, to also pick you up for that. So I think people have maybe had either a false belief or a hope that if you're a US citizen, there's not a lot they can do to you. Ironically, this shooting happened about a mile away from where George Floyd was killed in 2020. And there has been a long level of discourse among black Americans for a long time that if you get to a traffic stop, that is something that's really dangerous for you. You know, they are on a hair trigger. And maybe white Americans didn't realise until quite recently that this was something that was really quite scary for black Americans. So I think there's all of that into it. But I don't know if you've ever watched any videos of police protests, you know, interacting with protesters here. It's something that police sort of are trained to deal with, is people getting gobby, getting lippy with them. And most of the training is oriented around de-escalation, because normally you have a handful of police officers and several, you know, being outnumbered heavily by protesters. So I think that's one of the things that really comes across in that, is that the instinct for these people was not to de-escalate. It was to try and drag this woman out of her car. And again, the manuals for most law enforcement in America say, don't shoot into a moving vehicle. Unless you think that person is a mortal danger to others, let them escape. You've got their license plates. You've got the picture of what they look like. You can, you know, you'll be able to identify them and arrest them later. And instead of doing that, they escalated the situation. And I think that is something that is, it does feel like it's changed in the last couple of years.
Because she did say, the number of plates will be the same tomorrow. We're just going home to park.
Mm. Yeah. I mean, you could say this is a result of poorly trained, poorly disciplined officers, or you could say this is exactly the result that was inevitable with the policies that this administration is pursuing.
I'm not going to ask if things are going to improve, because you've given me no reason to ask that question.
I don't see under what... I mean, Trump gave an interview to the New York Times last week in which he said, there's no restraints on me except me and what I think.
Well, he actually said his personal morality, and I thought, well, we really are screwed then, because he haven't got any of that.
I mean, to link this back to world affairs, that's the same case with Greenland. Is Europe really prepared to, go to war with America? Mm. And he's taking the bet that we won't. There'll be no real diplomatic or financial consequences if he violated Article 5 of NATO. Mm. So who is going to stop him, is the question.
And but his only personal morality is that of ownership. And he cannot seem to get it into his head that Greenland is part of NATO. It has an enormous American base on it. If he'd like it to be more secure, they'd be very happy to have even more enormous American bases on it, spending as much money as humanly possible. It's inbuilt into Greenland to be secure. That's the point of it. But that's not enough. For him, he has to own it. And that's true in all of his dealings, even in Gaza, for goodness sake. There is no point in anything for Trump unless he personally owns it.
Unless he owns it and puts his name on it. Mm. So it will be turned into Trump land the minute he's taken it over, won't it?
Like the Trump Kennedy Center.
Big sign across the front.
Yeah, but you're right. That's the story of Venezuela's oil. That's the story of Greenland's natural resources. That's the story of the bad deal that he wanted Ukraine to sign, that essentially they were going to pay for the war out of by handing over their minerals to America. It's just like, I've got a bigger gun than you and I want it, so why can't I have it? So, yeah, sorry, Andy, about that. For you know, the new year, I'm not bringing sunshine and joy and light. I'm bringing a kind of... I would think quite carefully about travelling to America if you don't have to.
Right, you're grounded.
I'd play it safe and go back to Riyadh if I were you, Helen.
Exactly. I want to go somewhere where the rule of law means something. Saudi Arabia.
5 years ago, I was paying $65 a month for my subscriptions. Today, those same subscriptions cost $111, and I don't even use half of them anymore. That's why now I use Rocket Money to manage my subscriptions for me. The app gives you a list of all your subscriptions and reminds you of upcoming payments so you're not hit with any surprise charges. On top of that, it also sends you alerts when subscription prices go up, so you always know the price you're paying. If you decide you no longer want a subscription, you can cancel it right from the app. No customer service needed. And the best part is, Rocket Money even reaches out and tries to get you refunded for some of the money you lost. On average, people that cancel their subscriptions with Rocket Money save $378 a year. And overall, Rocket Money has saved its members $880 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Right. There's now another newest member of Reform in town. Very exciting. Mr. Nadeem Zahawi.
An exciting new talent. Yeah, that they've unearthed from somewhere. Yeah.
Former Chancellor.
Disgraced former Chancellor, I think.
For 2 days.
Say,
yeah.
Yes. Nigel Farage, when he was announcing him, said that Zahawi had the necessary conviction, which I thought was
it was only a fine.
Yeah. Pretty tough on the rest of the Reform candidates who've got, you know, proper ones. No, I mean... Yet another appointment of a man with, after 2 seconds inquiry by even the least diligent of hacks, an extraordinary dodgy backstory that you would think, why do you want to appoint this man? This man was found by the ethics committee to be guilty of not declaring that he had the tax authorities looking into him while he was a cabinet minister. That isn't good. Yeah. Not by any old standard, just generally.
Ian, it was only £3.7 million of unpaid tax. Which of us has not just occasionally neglected to pay that amount?
I know, and now I'm going to get lectures on how I'm a metropolitan elite by a guy who has stables, which, to be fair, aren't very metropolitan, but, like, nonetheless, it's just, again, it's just, the whole thing is mind-blowing.
Yeah. And this is the man who said one of the things that attracted him to Reform was belief in freedom of speech. Now, there was very little enthusiasm by Mr. Zahawi for freedom of speech when he said, I'd been smeared by journalists. Smeared in the sense of they told the truth about him, which he then had to admit and say he should have declared it earlier and then pay his unpaid capital gains tax and his fine. That's a new definition of freedom of speech.
Rather a lot of legal letters, I recall, rocketing about, warning journalists off to exercising their freedom of speech and even asking Mrs. Zahawi questions at the time.
Well, yes, and in his very first interview, I sound as though I'm obsessed, but I cannot believe it. We have to watch this man being declared as exciting new candidate, exciting new member of Reform. And then he's asked a question, and he says, that's a stupid question. And then he has a go at the journalist for going on about it. We're going on about your extremely dodgy past. You keep making these mistakes. Mistakes originally in declaring your expenses with the stables. More mistakes all the way along the line. And now you've joined Reform, which, if I may say so, is a catastrophic mistake, for which you will no doubt apologise at some point.
It's all so MAGA, though. The idea that you wash out of mainstream politics or whatever it might have been, and then you end up kind of going into a populist party, and then you spend all your time when people bring up your past mistakes, then just having a go at the media. That is exactly how every bit of MAGA works. It's people who just who washed out of something, who failed at something else, who never got quite the recognition that they thought they deserved. Yeah. They end up in a populist right party, which is a bit offensive to the voters of those parties, right? That you just get a load of retreads, essentially.
Well, I think it's going to end up being very problematic for Nigel Farage, because his point has been, we need some people with experience that we can get in. But, I mean, this new alternative party that's going to take over from the Conservatives is starting to look very, very similar to the old Conservative Party. I mean, literally, it's the same people now, isn't it? There must have been about a dozen of them now.
But look, we're recording this in London, and I know that to get here today, you will have had to go through several Sharia no-go areas. London is in the grip of a crime wave run by foreign criminal gangs. We are seeing a flight from London, particularly of people who've got children. And that's Nigel Farage there. He's not talking about nursery fees. I'm not talking about people wanting to have a garden when they've got toddlers. No, he's talking about...
This is said with real conviction.
this is the sort of the politics of London and how it's, you know, become effectively 1980s New York for a lot of the imagination of various political parties. And in fact, New York now thinks of London as being like 1980s New York. It makes no sense in a lot of ways.
Oh yeah, no. If you put London in the with every American city in terms of like the homicide rate, but you know, we'd land by like some little tiny podunk town in Ohio somewhere.
Yeah.
So it is quite odd that it's been built up into this sort of like gang warfare Sharia wasteland.
The reason I started with the Farage quote is because there are a few bits of London-y news in the last few days which tie everything together. Reform have just announced their candidate for the next mayoral elections. I mean, 2.5 years before they happen, they're clearly planning on, you know, a long getting-to-know-you session for their candidate. It's called Lila Cunningham. And the latest stats for murder, or as apparently we're now having to call it homicide in London, are out.
I'm sorry. I have to translate myself to American, and I just can't undo it.
But 97 people were murdered in London in 2025. Obviously, each of those a tragedy, but it's the lowest rate per 100,000 people since comparable records began in 1997. So the head of the Metropolitan Police, Mark Rowley, has said the evidence is extremely clear that London is, on plenty of metrics, safer than it's been for a long time. You know, the murder rate is a 12th the rate of Chicago. There are crimes which are up. Theft from the person is up in a big way. Phone snatching is up in a big way. These are crimes which are often harder to police. If you have, you know, a couple of million people walking around with...
£600
in their hands. It is hard to police, but it is a crime that people see happening. It happens to plenty of people, and it's really annoying. And the police will often say, "Yeah, sorry, we can't help with that," you know. Or that's the perception that a lot of people have. So,
but they do say that about burglary in the rest of the country as well. Phone gets nicked in London, well, that's a bit of an effort. If your house gets burgled in quite a lot of the rest of the country, well, yeah, we'd love to help.
The Reform candidate for mayor last week, when she was unveiled, she talked about how unsafe she feels now. She wouldn't put her kids on the tube on their own, but when she was 11, she used to travel on the tube network, feeling absolutely fine. And I worked out, in terms of her age, she's talking about the late 80s, which is that point when I can remember the Guardian Angels. Do you remember them, Ian? The vigilantes from New York were brought into the London tube system, and there was stuff on the news about them roaming up and down in their silly little red berets because it was so rife with appalling crime. I find it a bit like after the sort of 7/7 bombings, and everyone said, you know, this is an absolutely unprecedented threat that we've never faced on the streets of London before. And I can remember coming up to London as a kid and being absolutely terrified about the IRA blowing up. That's why there weren't any bins in stations or anything. It was an absolute constant threat. You know, the Harrods bombing, the bombing of Canary Wharf and things, right into the 90s. So everyone seems to sort of just wipe that from their memories, and everything seems to be an eternal, the worst point ever, doesn't it, in terms of crime?
Yeah, and I think it's pretty clear why Reform are doing it. You can't win votes unless you're saying the country is completely broken, and particularly London.
It's weird to do it when you're running for mayor of London. I can understand if you're trying to run for anywhere that is a place where people have moved out of London, anywhere that's got very much older people who maybe find London really overwhelming and very different to how it wasn't the way they remember. It's very weird to run for an office on, like, elect me mayor of this shithole.
Well, you
is that going to work? I don't know. Maybe it will work.
But I think there actually is a reason to do it, and I think there's precedent for it as well. Cast your minds back to the halcyon days of 2024, which was the last time we had a mayoral election in London. Sadiq Khan was up for it for a third time for the Labour Party, and up against him was Susan Hall, Conservative Assembly member for London. Now, her campaign was extremely focused on this kind of thing. And her basic strategy was to go for lots of people living in... I mean, London's huge, you know, and it's huge and it's very diverse.
I knew you were going to say that.
But you're right.
But you get older voters, you get people in the outer suburbs who are older, they're socially conservative, they you know, they use their cars more, so lots of people were very worried before ULEZ came in, the ultra-low emission zone. Mm. Now, that was more of a worry before it came in, because 95% of cars turned out they were fine, they were compliant with ULEZ. But Susan Hall's campaign was really strongly pitched in those directions. And
but she did, in a very memorable interview, admit to never having been on a bus in London. And to all of us who have lived or live occasionally in London, never having been on a bus isn't a top qualification for becoming mayor. I mean, transport is the one issue in London that people are very cross about. They're cross with Sadiq Khan about the way transport works in London, the way cyclists, motorists and public services interact. All of those are valid criticisms. But I don't see that on the reform agenda. Where is let's kick TfL? I can't see that.
But then Zach Goldsmith tried to run his Conservative mayoral campaign also on the kind of like creeping Sharia immigration stuff and also lost. Whereas Boris Johnson very successfully won several terms as mayor under classic Boris boosterism. It's amazing. The city's brilliant. This is a place of innovation and dynamism. I don't know. I think the biggest challenge to Sadiq Khan is his extremely pallid record as mayor. I don't think anyone really could. Nothing springs to mind immediately as a great Sadiq Khan achievement. He hasn't even really managed to put his name on anything. And then just a general sense that people would probably quite like to give Labour, who are very unpopular, a kicking.
Yeah, right? Absolutely. Yeah. I do think that people putting your name on things is not a good qualification for, like, putting your name on the Boris bikes is not, or the Boris buses, which heat up to 40 degrees on a mildly warm day in spring. All of that, it's not perfect.
But apt.
Yeah, true.
I also think it is funny at the beginning of a year when I'm worrying whether the private eye ironometer is still working. A woman comes in and says she's declaring an all-out war on crime, and then it turns out she's committed criminal offences herself in terms of not filing accounts on three separate companies. I mean, that is quite funny.
Three of her companies were struck off, weren't they? Sort of forcibly struck off because she hadn't filed the relevant documentation.
And I did check, just in case the lawyers are interested, it is a criminal offence not filing your accounts. They didn't prosecute her. They struck the companies off, but they could have done. Yeah. And all this has been denied and swept under the carpet. And Farage says she's a successful entrepreneur. Well, not very, because these companies have all folded. And one of them was selling magnesium and menthol-infused roll-on lotion. And is this the bright future of entrepreneurial London?
What for? That's a deodorant, surely. That sounds like one of those woo-woo deodorants. That's my theory.
Yeah.
Her second husband is involved in crypto, so that's presumably on brand reform.
Oh, that must be how
she met
Nigel.
But again, this isn't a candidate that you would immediately think they must choose that.
I think the tough on crime message could theoretically work, but you've got to persuade more people that London is a really ghastly place, which is quite hard because lots of quite targeted policing has brought various offences down. Luxury watch theft is the big thing that lots of very wealthy people worry about. They say, well, I'm not wearing my Rolex in London anymore. That's come down, I think, two-thirds within the last 2 years, between one year and the next, because they've done a lot of clever policing about it.
I just love the idea of being a populist party. You're like, we speak for the working man.
Quite a
and our number one issue,
isn't it? It's probably not going to sweep you into power of City Hall, which is the owner's Rolex watch.
But I bet Nick Candy's worried about it, you know.
I bet he is.
Despite being named after something you shouldn't do to a baby. Anyway, the policy which could work, or the area that Farage gave this tiny mention to, it went in this launch of Lila Cunningham as a candidate, was, oh, well, you know, you used to know your local police officer or local teacher or whatever, now they've all had to leave because they can't afford to live in London. Affordability is a massive problem in London, and it's weird that no one is making more hay with it. You know?
Well, that's what drove Zohran Mamdani in New York to his victory, right? He's got a very leftist set of political positions, but actually he really did not talk about them at all. He ran a pure affordability. The rent is too damn high. Mm. Halal vans can't get licences and you're paying too much for your kofta. Like, it was just exactly that broad message, which, whether you're old or young in London, most people think London is a bit too expensive, whether it's about rents or it's about house prices or it's about your TfL or whatever it might be. And I'm kind of interested about whether or not a pure affordability message would have actually been a smarter one for reform to go with.
Yeah,
they have kind of got a problem, haven't they, in the same way that sort of supporters of them in the media like GB News have. It involves being very, very proudly patriotic, but consistently saying that everything about the country or the capital city is completely shit. And that's quite a sort of hard thing to bridge sometimes, isn't it?
Yeah, the Boris boosterism did sort of cheer everyone up, even if a lot of it was rubbish, you know.
But they seem to have given up on the sunlit uplands now. It just seems to be everything is just awful.
Welcome to Mordor.
Yeah. For us.
But it's quite a corporate role. I remember going to events where Boris Johnson would come and talk to people who worked in the city, And he would go and give a speech about how marvellous they all were, and they went, we are very much, like charity events. And I don't think necessarily that group of people want to hear, this is miserable, like, welcome to, as you say, welcome to Mordor. Yeah. They want people to come and invest in London. Like, that's part of also what that Mayor of London role has always been, is advocating for London as a global city that you would bring investment inwards.
Yeah. I literally was in Shaftesbury Avenue the other day, and a very nice woman got off the bus. She'd come in to see a show, and she said, could you tell me where the theatre is? Because I'm very worried about walking anywhere in London. And I said, it's there. You literally have to just get off the steps and get in there. But I promise you, you'll probably be fine. And wow. I think the newspapers have given a version of London that chimes with their own prejudices, which is bordering on the silly. We've run a lot of parodies of, quite often, according to Adam, expat columnists who say, you know, I visited London the other day, first time in years, and, you know, I was terrified. And it does read really very pathetically with any sort of historical perspective.
Yeah. So to go into a few of the actual crimes themselves, we've done homicide, we've done theft from the person, we've done luxury watch theft, we've done the biggies. Violent crime has gone up between 2015 and 2025. That's a problem. That's something you can definitely charge Sadiq with. I said that wrong. You can't charge him
he
with
did
a violent...
them all, actually. Yeah, the lawyers are listening. He did every single one.
Gun crime is lower in London than in plenty of other bits of the UK, and it's down, I think it's down pretty much everywhere.
Like, what about knife crime?
Knife crime, it is down in the last year, but it is higher than it was a decade ago.
It's down from quite high, isn't it?
It's I think pretty close to the pre-pandemic peak, which is at about 2019. So yeah. knife crime is definitely one of the ones where the policing hasn't worked yet.
Again, a campaign about what is really happening, I don't think would worry anyone.
Yeah, there are plenty
saying
of problems.
We need more policing is, on the whole, very popular with all parties and nearly all demographics at all time. So that's not a problem. It's just this exaggerated and sort of hysterical view of what's happening in the capital that I think is completely unhelpful.
The biggest flub in the 2024 Conservative campaign that Susan Hall was running was that they produced these very scary black and white videos of hellhole London, one of which turned out to be from Pennsylvania Station in New York. I mean, it was a perfect example of you're trying to say this is like Gotham City, and it's not. It's got plenty of problems. It's got plenty of political problems. It's got plenty of problems with housing and with affordability and with lots of crime. I mean, knife crime, you know, is pretty high.
Yeah.
But as you say,
reform then always links levels of crime with immigration and suggests that no one has noticed that there are any problems in a capital city with large amounts of immigration. And always suggests that the press in particular never covers anything. And Sharia law is going on under the radar, totally undetected. I mean, on the whole, I mean, a story, for example, like the fun run where in Tower Hamlets, where the adult women weren't allowed to run. It was a fun run for everyone, and there was a cut-off age for girls. Mm-hmm. I mean, we ran this story in the Eye. It was picked up by nearly everybody, and then the mosque had to do a U-turn. Girls are now allowed to run at every age. These things are not being ignored, except by the people who don't want to see them and say no one covers any of this. Right. You know, there are things that happen, and they are covered.
We've covered a few times on this podcast the question of, does it matter what reality is when there are very effective messages being portrayed and promulgated? So
the answer is yes. Next.
Fine. 51% of adults think that violent crime overall is going up, which is not. 7% of people think it's falling, which it is.
I think it really matters because when I looked at that poll and it was, you know, 2024 reform voters were the most likely to say London wasn't unsafe. I thought, if you think about that demographically, that is older people who are now, some of them presumably frightened to leave their houses if they live in London or they were thinking about coming to London to the theatre. And people should have a realistic understanding of, yes, London does have problems. Yes, you might find people smoking a joint on the tube with you. You might find people, like, as you say, phone thefts, watch thefts, whatever it might be. There are petty crimes and stuff like that. But this is not the south side of Chicago. And it should be OK to say so without people kind of going, oh, you liberal elite don't want to hear any about it.
I'm really sorry. You've just reminded me of one crime that we didn't read out the stats on, which is racist incidents at Dulwich College, which are down massively since the late 70s.
Did you notice that Mr. Zahawi was asked about Nigel Farage's record of anti-Semitism at Dulwich. And he said, if you think for a minute that I would be here if I thought Nigel had anything against people of my colour, you're thinking, no, no, it wasn't. It was the Jews, wasn't it? Can we bring them up here? This isn't what we were on about.
But it also doesn't take very long to unearth an article that Nadim Zahawi wrote in 2015 for Conservative Home, taking a very, very strong line on that then.
His exact words on that, Farage was proposing ending race discrimination laws. Zahawi's exact words were, Goebbels would be proud, which...
And that's a good thing.
We now understand.
Well done.
5 years ago, I was paying $65 a month for my subscriptions. Today, those same subscriptions cost $111, and I don't even use half of them anymore. That's why now I use Rocket Money to manage my subscriptions for me. The app gives you a list of all your subscriptions and reminds you of upcoming payments so you're not hit with any surprise charges. On top of that, it also sends you alerts when subscription prices go up, so you always know the price you're paying. If you decide you no longer want a subscription, you can cancel it right from the app. No customer service needed. And the best part is, Rocket Money even reaches out and tries to get you refunded for some of the money you lost. On average, people that cancel their subscriptions with Rocket Money save $378 a year. And overall, Rocket Money has saved its members $880 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Okay, we now come to section number three, and Adam, it's over to you. I gather we're going to get an exciting visitor from America in the next few days.
Ah, all the excitement at the moment seems to be about whether Meghan is going to come over in the summer. But we do know we are going to get the other half. Prince Harry is very likely to rock up in London. I'm told he's enormously looking forward to fronting down the Daily Mail, for it is they in court, over this long-running case he's had against them for all sorts of unlawful activities which he alleges went on.
Now, I have become totally, totally lost with... the story of Prince Harry suing everybody.
It is Prince Harry versus the world. Basically. It's the case that was announced in a flurry of publicity back in October 2022. And he's bringing it along with a host of other celebs. So Liz Hurley, Elton John and David Furnish, Simon Hughes, the former Lib Dem MP. That's probably stretching the definition.
I was going to say, they got a lot less glamorous very quickly.
Sadie Frost, great kind of Britpop film star. And Baroness Lawrence as well, who is the mother of murdered teenager Stephen Lawrence, all of whom are alleging that specifically private investigators working on behalf of the Mail and Mail on Sunday many years ago used unlawful methods to get information, private information on them, and published stories as a result of it.
Okay.
Now, at that point, they were talking about all sorts of unlawful activities. We kind of moved on from phone hacking. Phone hacking was kind of the first stage of all this kind of stuff, and the Leveson inquiry came out of that. Now it's moved on to, well, I mean, what was alleged, and is very hotly denied by everyone at the Mail, was abhorrent criminal activity, in the words of the first legal claim. They alleged that premises had been bugged. I think cars had been bugged as well. Live phone calls had been recorded, and even burglaries undertaken to order.
What?
Wow. That's spectacular, isn't it? Yeah, that's not part of the case anymore. That one's fallen away.
Tell me if I'm wrong, the Prince Harry legal strategy is throw everything against the wall and see what sticks.
It does really appear to be that. And the judge who has been appointed to deal with this and has been doing so over an awful lot of pretrial hearings over the last couple of years, Mr. Justice Nicklin, has been very insistent throughout that he is not going to allow this to turn into another Leveson inquiry, just sort of a wide-ranging inquiry into possible wrongdoing by the entire press. He wants it absolutely honed in on specifics and very, very provable things. And in this... they're kind of lucky because they've got some of the private investigators who were working for the Daily Mail at the time on board. So case looked pretty, pretty strong. It sort of slightly started to come apart along the way because it turns out that those private investigators mostly have convictions for all sorts of other things, largely phone hacking. So Glenn Mulcair is one of them, who was the original man who stood trial twice for phone hacking, first time around at the News of the World, and second time he was in the dock alongside Andy Coulson and Rebecca Brooks, who is innocent of everything. They've got some other ones in there as well, some really charming people. Greg Miskew, who was another one who was jailed over the News of the World and has since died, but left some pretty spectacular testimony in forms of witness statements behind him. Jonathan Rees, who has been to prison, not for phone hacking, just to make things change, for planting drugs on a woman whose husband had employed him to discredit her during a divorce proceedings. Gavin Burrows, who problematically has given contradictory witness statements to both sides. For Prince Harry's side, he said that he had undertaken lots of unlawful activities on behalf of the male titles. And for the male titles, he said that he absolutely hadn't done that. Not only that, but that the witness statement saying he had was a forgery and the signature on it wasn't his.
He's good. I like him.
The other person who they've got a witness statement from, which is apparently going to be presented at trial, is Christine Joanna Hart, who now claims that she was the psychic medium to News International over several years. She's now a practicing shaman. She says she never hacked phones. What she did was she opened the Stargates, she spoke to the Nordics and read from the codes embedded in blood to reveal how Fleet Street used her to uncover extraterrestrial influence between murder and media and how powerful forces, celebrity, royalty and empire moved to silence her. So they put her in the witness box. That's going to be quite a fun day in court.
She sounds terrific. She should have a horoscope column.
She's pretty fab.
I think she's at The Economist now, I think. So those are the people who are providing witness statements for Harry's side.
They have at various points whether or not those will actually be presented in court, but they have come up at...
But like there's a mosaic coming in from them of support. Okay.
And how, Adam, have these people been recruited when they were previously on the other side? They were very much the poachers and now become the kind of gamekeepers on Harry's side.
Well, obviously they're all enormously repentant now and think that everything they did before was absolutely terrible and acting out of the goodness of their own heart. But also quite a lot of them have received quite a bit of money. They were recruited by a chap called Graham Johnson, who is currently working alongside Dr. Evan Harris, former director of Hacked Off, as a paralegal on this particular case. But prior to that, the two of them were working together in kind of exposing lots and lots of bad behaviour by the press via a website called Byline. Byline Investigates, in fact. It's a sister to the Byline newspaper, which comes out... Byline Times, yeah. It's associated with that, but it's not exactly the same thing. He's also got a website called Expose Media and a publishing company called Yellow Press, which has been splashing around advances for these people to write their memoirs. Quite big advances, actually, in terms of... Gavin Burrows said he got $25,000 for an advance, which is a lot of money to be getting in terms of advance, certainly from a very small publishing house. And there's a slight mystery as to where the funding behind that might have come from.
From whom does the funding come for all of this?
Well, is it a benefactor who doesn't mind how many copies are sold, as long as the truth is out there?
These are the sort of questions which the Mail Group have been trying to establish in these pre-trial hearings and will certainly be trying to establish at trial.
Are you allowed to pay people who are giving you witness statements?
The argument would be that it wasn't directly for the witness statements. You just happened to have paid this person for their autobiography.
Feels wrong.
That would be up to the judge to decide. I mean, we certainly wouldn't have a view on that.
And this is judge trial, not
it's a judge
no
trial,
jury.
No jury involved, no. Harry's side, I have to say, have been less than happy about kind of opening up their books to show what was going on with that. So there's a process ahead of trial called disclosure, where each side has to volunteer up evidence, sort of emails and paperwork and that kind of thing. So
you're looking at me as though I've never done this.
Yeah, I know you have.
I'm enjoying
this one,
it.
This one for the listeners rather than those quite experienced in it. One of the arguments late last year in court was whether Evan Harris and Graham Johnson should have to hand over all of their kind of paperwork and evidence from before they were actually brought in as paralegals to work on this particular case, which is relevant because, as I say, they were working together to bring the stuff onto this website and expose these stories. And these stories appearing on Byline Investigates are being used as the watershed moment, is the phrase that's getting used in court, that the various litigants realise that they might have a claim against the Mail on Sunday.
Right.
That's relevant because there's a statute of limitations of 6 years. We're talking about events which largely went on right back into the noughties, possibly even back as far as the 90s. Now, that's not a very attractive argument by the Daily Mail to say, well, you should have known we were doing unlawful stuff before and you should have sued us, given particularly that Paul Dacre, who was the big cheese at the Daily Mail, denied very, very strongly and has continued to all the way through any unlawful activity ever undertaken. I should say, of course, Dacre and everyone at the Mail continue to deny this in the strongest possible terms. They say that all of these claims are not only lurid but preposterous, because they know how to give a denial. And they, I think, too, are feeling quite confident in this. So confident, in fact, that they very unusually, in a case like this, and again, you will back me up on this, Ian, they had a costs hearing pre-trial to really sort of hammer at home to the various litigants in this quite how much they stand to lose if they are not successful in this case. Because obviously Prince Harry, Elton John, David Furnish, quite deep pockets, possibly Sadie Frost, bit more concerned about the mortgage and things. So, and it was pointed out to them that if parts of the litigation succeed but others fail, those who fail become liable for an enormous number of costs. I mean, we're talking in the estimate is that both sides have spent at least 40 million so far.
40 million?
Do you mean all the costs could end up being heaped on, say, just Simon Hughes?
Yeah. Or not all the costs, but an enormous, the costs pertaining to his part of the the litigation. So this is high risk.
You have made the point right the way through this that going together as a group with Prince Harry as your leader may not have been the best strategy. Were you Stephen Lawrence's mother, you might have thought you'd do better on your own.
It's a possibility, isn't it? Yeah, yeah. I mean, Prince Harry essentially thinks that anything written about him anywhere in any newspaper ever is a crime. And also, he's very little idea, I think, of the value of money either. I mean, probably 40 million to him doesn't seem like an enormous amount of money. So he's not necessarily the person you want to have kind of driving your case. Unless there be any doubt, this absolutely is being driven by Prince Harry. I mean, one of my favourite details of this is that Prince Harry, his watershed moment, as we discussed before, when he realised he might have a case, was when he met David Sherborne, who is the barrister who was in charge of an awful lot of these cases, and a lot of the Mirror ones and News of the World ones as well. Bit of a schmoozer, bit of a smoothie chops. Guess where Harry bumped into him? On holiday at Elton and David's house in France.
Charming.
Very, very nice.
How charming.
And Harry, rather wonderfully, was then given the job of phoning up or messaging, I think, WhatsApping possibly, Baroness Lawrence. Because, you know, to break the news to a baroness that she might have a claim, you need a prince for that, obviously. That's the way that one works.
It would I'd just get scammed from that. If I got a text from an unknown number saying it's Prince Harry here, and you could be in line for millions of pounds, but come on, this is the Nigerian prince thing.
In
but
reverse.
Andy doesn't want to hear any of this because he's a huge fan of Meghan and her cookery programme. This is all very painful. The idea that she might lose. She maybe should
Helen,
have to.
Hang on, you
maybe
said you'd keep this off air.
Maybe she'll have to make more with Love, Meghan, if she's not got any money as a result of losing this. You're going to get all the jam recipes your heart could desire.
Let's move on.
I mean, one of the other slightly dubious things about it is that, as we were saying about the watershed moment thing and the statute of limitations, there are emails as well between Evan Harris and Simon Hughes, both former Lib Dem MPs, discussing the mail business back in 2016. And Evan Harris saying, I propose to bring along my investigative journalist, was how he was describing him, which is Johnson at that point, to discuss things.
Right.
But then the claim is that Simon Hughes had no idea any of this might have been going on until he read it in Byline News. 3 years after that, so well within the statute of limitations in 2019. Again, slightly awkwardly, there's also a load of emails of the draft copies of the articles that Byline was going to publish being sent to him for his approval and being delayed for 6 months because he just started a new job and didn't want the publicity at that point.
Right.
And rather wonderfully, Evan Harris ghostwriting Sadie Frost's outraged reaction to this news to her that she might have been the victim of unlawful activity. So there's an awful lot of kind of juicy stuff that's come out already and will be discussed at great length at the Royal Courts of Justice in the weeks to come.
And when we get into court, as it were, or possibly physically in your case, who are we rooting for, Adam?
Yeah, it's a tough one, isn't it?
It's like when Fyad sued the Hamiltons, isn't it? Or was it the other way around?
No, I was in court and I was rooting for them both to lose.
Yes, yeah.
Which, in a sense, they both did, and it was marvellous. But is this similar? I mean, the trouble about having Doreen Lawrence there and some of those people is you think they might have a case.
It's really, really hard to see. I mean, until the full trial comes out and we see exactly what evidence they've got, it's going to be very, very hard to see. I mean, if Doreen Lawrence has been dragged into this and it turns out not to be anything, that's pretty
poor.
Forgivable,
I'm very surprised really, really because is. I would say, you know, people I know, I worked at the Daily Mail for several years, and one of the things that Paul Dacre was most proud of was his involvement in the Stephen Lawrence case.
Yeah, we should say, I mean, we haven't covered that. That really hits to the heart of the Daily Mail under Paul Dacre. I mean, quite rightly, he was enormously proud of that murderer's front page and the fact that he named and shamed the suspects in the Lawrence murder, two of whom, I think, have since gone to prison.
Yeah, convicted
and gone
big
to
front
prison.
Page, five pictures as murderers, and he had it hanging in his office for the entire time. Like, this was a time he took a big call in which he could have been sent to prison for over a racist murder. Mm. And so I think that's the one that I'm surprised to
again,
see
that that's
will
the one that elevates it. I have to say as well, this does kind of go rather wider than the Mail because a lot of journalists are named in the litigation so far who have gone on to very senior jobs at other papers. In fact, four serving current national newspaper editors. So we've got Tony Gallagher, who was a news editor at the Mail at the time and has now gone on to edit the Times. Ben Taylor at the Sunday Times. Victoria Newton, who was a showbiz reporter on the Mail at the time, now editing the Sun. And David Dillon, who has stayed but is editing the Mail on Sunday under Ted Verity, the current editor of both Mail titles there. It's ancient history in some ways, but there's a lot of the players in it still very much around.
That's it for this episode of Page 94. Thank you so much for listening. If you would like to find out the latest about the Harry trial, the more on ICE, there'll be more American columns before long, just go to your local newsagent and walk in and put down a very small amount of money on the counter, $2.99. It's ridiculous. I've been meaning to talk to you about this, Ian. It's crazy.
Well, we had a letter last week from a reader who wasn't me, saying, why is your magazine A so cheap and why is the subscription so cheap? I mean, this is ludicrous. People are paying three times this for a pint, twice as much as this for a cup of coffee. I mean, this is the sort of letter I can guarantee will be published if you want to send it in.
Printed it twice, I think. Yeah. Anyway, if you would like to
framed it,
secure this bargain before things change, just go to private-i.co.uk, get yourself a subscription. It's a fantastic magazine and there's so much more inside. That's it for the next fortnight. We will see you again next time. Thank you as ever for listening, and thank you to Matt Hill of Rethink Audio for producing. Bye for now.